Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Katie Weaver, Susan Shand, and John Russell. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Katie Weaver.
People climbing Mount Everest are 2 times as likely to reach the top and less likely to die on the climb than 20 years ago, a new study finds. Everest, high in the Himalayas, is the tallest mountain above sea level on Earth. It reaches 8,848 meters into the sky. Between 2006 and 2019, around 2/3 of climbers were successful in their attempt to reach the top. In the 15 years before that, only about 1/3 went all the way to the top. The study was a project of researchers at the University of Washington and the University of California, Davis. They found that the risk of dying on the mountain was 0.5% for women and 1.1% for men in recent years. That is down from 1.9% and 1.7% in the period from 1990 to 2005, the researchers said. The number of attempts to reach the top of Everest has risen sharply over the years, leading to a 300% increase in overcrowding. In 2019, 955 climbers tried to reach the mountaintop. Only 222 people did so in 2000. The study noted that on a single day in May of last year, 396 climbers had gathered at the narrow path just below the top. The area, known as the Death Zone, is so narrow that only a small number of climbers can pass through, one directly behind another. 9 climbers died on Everest in May 2019. It was the deadliest Everest climbing season since 2015, when an earthquake killed at least 18 people on the mountain. A picture of climbers waiting their turn to go up and down through the death zone became famous as it was shared online. Yet researchers say the crowds were not the main reason for the deaths last year. Surprisingly, crowding has no evident effect on success or death of Everest climbers, the study said. However, overcrowding does make the climb more dangerous. If crowding slows climbers, as is expected, this increases their exposure to the elements, which should increase risk of an accident or illness, said Raymond B. Huey, lead writer of the report. An unexpected storm, earthquake, or landslide could be disastrous, he told Reuters by email. I'm Katie Weaver.
Telehealth is an American idea that seems to have been accepted by everyone during the coronavirus pandemic. It involves talking to a doctor on a computer or smartphone. Medicare is America's government-paid health care for older Americans and the disabled. It changed its rules to permit doctors to use telehealth to see patients. Now there is a push to make telemedicine available to everyone in the future. Talking to a doctor on a computer or phone increased a lot when communities shut down in early spring because of the virus. Telehealth visits decreased as things slowly reopened, but they are still far more common than before. Expanding telehealth will involve creating a balance between cost and quality. Some are worried about privacy or fraud. I don't think it is ever going to replace in-person visits, because sometimes a doctor needs to put hands on a patient, said Seema Verma. She is the head of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid and the Trump administration's leader in the movement for increased telehealth. It's fair to say that telemedicine, it's come of age this year, said Mary Aitken of the data company IQVIA. It studies the use of telemedicine. During the coronavirus shutdown, telehealth made up more than 40% of basic care visits for patients with traditional Medicare. Before coronavirus, it was only 0.1% of care. As the government's main health care program, Medicare covers more than 60 million people. A recent poll of older Americans by the University of Michigan Institute for Healthcare Policy and Innovation found that more than 70% of people are interested in using telehealth for follow-ups with their doctor. Privacy, however, was an issue, mostly for those who had not experienced telemedicine. The poll found 27% of older Americans who had not had a telemedicine visit were worried about privacy. Among those who had tried telemedicine, only 17% were worried about privacy. Many others who tried telemedicine did have some worries. About 80% were concerned the doctor could not physically examine them, and 64% worried the quality was not as good. In the past, traditional Medicare had restricted telemedicine to those who live far out in the country and had to travel long distances to see a doctor. When the coronavirus hit the U.S., officials changed the restrictions so Medicare users could use telemedicine. Making such changes permanent would require legislation from Congress. Senator Lamar Alexander is chairman of the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee. He says he would like to see greater use of telemedicine while keeping costs down. The goal, he said, should be better outcomes and better patient experiences at a lower cost. I'm Susan Shand.
Across America, many public spaces are taking on an unlikely new responsibility this fall. They are welcoming children for distance learning while their parents go to work. Among such places are martial arts centers, dance schools, community centers, and libraries. With many schools still closed because of the coronavirus crisis, a lot of Americans are looking for places to provide supervised learning to children during the workday. These places can help families that had difficulties with distance learning last spring. But organizers admit they are a poor replacement for schools with professional educators. One example is in Broward County, Florida. When schools in the area announced plans to begin the new year with distance learning, dance studio owner Katie Gaughan thought immediately about the difficulties facing working parents. Her dance school, Dance Explosion Company in Hollywood, Florida, hired a temporary teacher. The teacher is there from 7 a.m. to 3 p.m. to make sure the students are studying. The dance school program costs $150 a week, or $35 a day. I thought to myself, what would my parents have done with me? Gaughan said. She added that she wanted to reduce any stress that parents might be under right now, trying to find somewhere for their kids to do their schoolwork. The dance school currently accepts 10 children during the day. All of them wear face coverings. Gaughan says temperature checks are carried out and the children are urged to use hand sanitizer often. Some experts note, however, that inviting students to gather in new spaces could increase the risk of caregivers catching the virus. Dr. Eileen Marty is a disease specialist at Florida International University. She told the Associated Press that the only way groups outside of school will work is if you know everybody in that group, a very small group, and everyone is tested and tested negative. Jennifer Quisenberry, a 37-year-old nurse practitioner, is sending her 6-year-old daughter, Audra, to a distance learning camp. The program is held at Premier Martial Arts in Wildwood, Missouri. Her daughter's school district is beginning the year online, but Jennifer and her husband have to go to work. "We can't not come to work," Quisenberry said. "My partners said I could bring Audra to work, but a hospital is not an ideal setting for a 6-year-old in the middle of a pandemic." While many wealthy American parents are turning to so-called learning pods and private teachers, nonprofits and local governments are trying to help low-income families. In Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, city officials announced recently that they would open 31 drop-off sites at community centers, libraries, and other places. The program will pay attention to families with the greatest need, including those who cannot afford childcare and those who do not have internet at home. San Francisco is creating community learning hubs at 40 places across the city to help with distance learning for children who are poor, homeless, in foster care, or learning English as a second language. In Kansas City, Missouri, the Parks Department is working with nonprofit groups to offer distance learning to hundreds of students. For students from Kansas City Public Schools, the city's poorest district, the program is free. It is tough for parents with school-aged children who are too old to go to preschool, and hiring a babysitter or nanny is not an option for their finances, said Roosevelt Lyons, Deputy Director of Operations for the Parks Department. Carrie Hutchcraft is the Chief Administrator with the Magic House, a children's museum in Kirkwood, Missouri. The museum offers a distance learning program for about 80 students each day. Hutchcraft's own 9- and 7-year-olds will be among them. I feel like they already have got behind in learning new things last year, but we can't do that again, she said. I'm John Russell.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in Special English. I'm Steve Ember. The Constitution became law once 9 of America's 13 original states ratified it. The Continental Congress set a date for the new plan of government to take effect, the first Wednesday in March of 1789. In 1789, the population of the United States was about 4 million. The 13 states had been loosely united for a short time, only about 10 years. Before that, they were separate colonies of Britain. Because the colonies were separate, they developed different ways of life, different economies, different traditions. Americans were fiercely independent, but the crisis of the American Revolution brought them together. Together, they celebrated the 4th of July, the day in 1776 when America declared its independence from Britain. Together, they fought British troops to make that declaration a political reality. And together they joined under the Latin phrase, a pluribus unum, one out of many. Yet they did not really consider themselves a national people. When the war ended, the soldiers returned to their home states. They still thought of themselves first as New Yorkers, or Virginians, or Marylanders. Americans of 1789 were sharply divided on the need for a national government. Many were afraid the new government would not survive. They feared the anarchy that would result if it failed. Others hoped it would fail. They wanted strong state governments, not a strong central government. Also in 1789, the American economy was improving after the destruction caused by the Revolutionary War. Agriculture, trade, and shipbuilding were coming back to life. Roads, bridges, and canals were being built. The country's economy still had many problems, however. Two major issues had to be settled. One was the repayment of loans made to support the Revolutionary Army. The other was the creation of a national monetary system. Both issues needed quick action. And before the new government could act, the old government still had work to do on other issues, like the question of a capital. At the time the states approved the Constitution, the Continental Congress was meeting in New York City. And that was where the Congress decided to place the new government. Later, the capital would be moved to Philadelphia for a while. Finally, it would be established in Washington, D.C., the District of Columbia. Next, members of the Continental Congress had to decide when the states would choose a president. They agreed to March 4, 1789, the same day the Constitution would go into effect. The states that ratified the Constitution chose electors to vote for a president. The result was not a surprise. They chose the hero of the Revolutionary War, George Washington. No one opposed the choice, except, perhaps, for George Washington himself. Here are actors having an imaginary conversation between James Madison and George Washington. Madison is trying to persuade Washington that he should be the new nation's first president.
Oh, sir, it must be you who serves as president. It is your influence that unites the states.
I can tell you honestly, I do not want the honor. I'm very much aware of my deficient education and the 10,000 embarrassments that will cause me in office. I would hope they could find a younger man. But I want nothing more but to return to Mount Vernon and tend to my farming.
But, sir, if your country should need you...
If called, I will serve.
Washington learned of his election while at Mount Vernon, his home in Virginia. He left for New York, where he was inaugurated on April 13th. Members of the new Congress were also elected on March 4th. One of the first things the Congress did was to reopen debate on the Constitution itself. Several states had set a condition for approving the document. They said a Bill of Rights listing the rights of all citizens must be added to the Constitution. Yale Law School professor Akhil Reed Amar says one of the most important parts of the Bill of Rights is its source, the people.
In effect, it's crowdsourced. And we, the people, actually say, where are the rights? And we get this Bill of Rights because of that conversation.
To many Americans, the Bill of Rights represents the heart and soul of the Constitution. Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas has said that when he reads the document, he gets chills.
There was always this underlying belief that we were entitled to be a full participant in We the People.
Just what is this Bill of Rights, and what does it say? The Bill of Rights is the name for the first 10 amendments to the Constitution. The First Amendment deals with freedom of expression, including, as Justice Clarence Thomas points out, freedom of religion.
The First Amendment is what? Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion or the free exercise thereof. In other words, stay out of it and leave people alone when it comes to their religion.
The First Amendment guarantees that religion and government will be separate. Congress cannot establish an official religion or interfere in the people's right to worship as they choose. The First Amendment also protects other rights. Here is the full text. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. In other words, people have a right to gather peacefully and to make demands of the government. Constitutional law expert Akhil Reed Amar says the idea of free expression can be found throughout the Bill of Rights.
And even before there's the text of freedom of speech, there's the practice of freedom of speech. Five times the Bill of Rights uses the same phrase, the people, in the first, and the second, and the fourth, and the ninth, and the tenth amendments.
Mr. Amar says he believes the Bill of Rights says the people so often because the document comes from the people. The Second Amendment deals with guns. Here is what it says. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. The Third Amendment says people may not be forced to let soldiers stay in their homes during peacetime. The next five amendments protect people's rights in the justice system. The Fourth Amendment protects people from unreasonable searches and seizures. It bars courts from approving warrants unless there is probable cause. And it says warrants should describe the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. The Fifth Amendment says people should not be tried for the most serious crimes unless a grand jury has first examined the evidence. It also bars people from being tried twice for the same offense. And it says the government cannot take people's property for public use without paying them a fair price. The Sixth Amendment says people accused of crimes have the right to a fair and speedy public trial by a jury. The aim is to guarantee that people are not kept in prison for a long time unless a jury has found them guilty of a crime. The Sixth Amendment also guarantees the right of the accused to be defended by a lawyer. It says they must be informed of the nature and cause of the charges against them. And it says they have the right to face and question their accusers. The Seventh Amendment guarantees the right to a jury trial in civil cases. The Eighth Amendment bars cruel and unusual punishments. The Ninth Amendment provides protection for other rights not stated directly in the Constitution. And the Tenth Amendment says any powers not delegated to the national government belong to the states or to the people. The exceptions are any powers that the Constitution prohibits states from having. So these first 10 amendments make up the Bill of Rights. Later, says law professor Akhil Reed Amar, more amendments were added to the Constitution.
As good as the founding was, the system kept getting better and better. We made amends for some of the flaws of the founders through a series of amendments, and that process continues today.
The Bill of Rights and the other changes that came later helped decrease the power of the federal government. Because these amendments limited the power of the federal government, many anti-federalists ended their opposition to the new government. Many agreed to help with the job of building the new nation. In all, 11 of the 13 states approved the Constitution before Washington was inaugurated as president. The last two states, North Carolina and Rhode Island, ratified it afterward. President Washington wanted the best men, Federalist or anti-Federalist, to be in his administration. The new nation needed strong leadership, and George Washington provided it.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.